I got his PhD from Stanford, then did postdocs at Los Alamos and UC Berkeley. Then he was on the research staff at IBM Almaden before moving to MIT. Probably those of you who studied even a little bit of quantum information know Ike best as one of the authors of the textbook Nielsen and Chuang, also called Ike and Mike. And today he's going to tell us about trapped ions.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to come here. It's really quite a pleasure for me to come to the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, one of the centers for inquiry in quantum information around the world. And I'd like to acknowledge for those of you on looking at this talk from video today that we cleverly arranged for this talk to be given on the day when almost every quantum information scientist is gone from Perimeter. This way, I'm free to give any statement as compelling as I wish with no question whatsoever, although I have been warned that there are still a few smart people left here. What I would like to tell you about is an adventure that we have been doing over the last 3 years, seeking to demonstrate Peter Shor's factoring algorithm. And to tell you the story, let me begin with a bit of history and a statement of a challenge about something. The history begins before this, when Richard Feynman, Charlie Bennett, and others said, let there be quantum computation. And then there was joy among experimentalists. But the experimentalists were left aghast with nothing to do with this amazing quantum computation until we see here Peter Shor's algorithm came. Now, Shor's factoring algorithm is based on the notion that if you find the period to a certain function here, f of x is a to the x mod n, where n is the number you would like to factor, then given this period, which I'll call r, you can plug it in to a formula, and when a is chosen randomly, co-prime with the number you wish to factor, then with probability greater than 50%, the result of this greatest common divisor expression is going to be a factor of n. This is a remarkable and obscure fact which Peter remembered and was able to harness in coming up with an algorithm where the quantum algorithm succeeds in finding r in a time which goes polynomially in the length, the number of digits in the number n, whereas classically the best known algorithm takes some time which goes exponentially in L or L divided by 3. Now, if this were to become experimental reality, that this could be done practically for large numbers, it would undermine widely used cryptographic systems, such as the ones that all of you are perhaps using in your BlackBerries. But what would it take to actually make this a reality? Well, let's look at Shor's algorithm itself. It is constructed of this kind of structure. It has an initial step which creates a superposition. This is the H at the beginning. Then there is the modular exponentiation, which computes this exponentiation on a superposition of values of x simultaneously in this notion of quantum parallelism on the bottom register shown here. Now, after doing this modular exponentiation, in superposition on all of the values of x, a quantum fast Fourier transform is performed. It's actually an inverse Fourier transform, but then the measurement of this will then give you enough to tell what the period r is. In addition to all of this, a great deal of classical pre-processing and post-processing is needed. For example, one needs to use a continued fraction expansion to obtain the period r from the numbers that are measured at the exit here. So if you'd like to reduce this to practice, you'd like to understand why this is an important algorithm to do and what the steps are. And I'd like you to appreciate that this structure of an algorithm using a quantum Fourier transform is a virtually universal idea to all the algorithms, quantum algorithms known today, which have an exponential speed up over a classical, virtually all of them. So for example, one of the most interesting recent ones is an algorithm known as the Harrell-Hasidim-Lloyd algorithm that allows one to sample solutions of a linear set of equations, AX equals B, something many of us have done even as early as high school, and estimate this in a time which is exponentially faster than is possible classically under certain realistic scenarios. And this notion is built on the idea of something known as quantum phase estimation, popularized by Michaela Maska here at Waterloo. Beyond this, there are also notions of quantum simulations, such as the ones that David Corey works on with nuclear magnetic resonance. So one can use this to find, for example, eigenvalues and sample them for molecular energies and other kind of quantum configurations. So it's a key building block, this Shor algorithm. The way the building block works if you wanted to look at its simplest possible case, would be to factor the number 15. You cannot factor a number which has a power of 2 in it, besides that would be trivial. So let us take this structure and reduce it step by step to see what one would do for factoring the number 15. Well, the very first step is that you know 15 is less than 16, and so there would be 4 bits would be sufficient to realize, represent the number 15. So let's start with that. You can have 4 bits down here. It turns out that if you remember the Nyquist criteria of the Fourier transform, you need approximately twice the number of bits, essentially to represent the space of the Fourier transform. So this is going to turn into twice the size of the bottom register, and what we get is a structure that looks kind of like this. So we have 4 qubits down here, 8 qubits on the top, and then a sequence of modular exponentials. So this bit controls an A, multiplication by A. So for example, if X0 were 1, then the bottom register would become A, multiplication by A squared, A to the 4th, A to the 8th, A to the 16th, and so forth. And then because of the sequence of multiplications, at the end here you would get X to the A. Now, X is a number that you plug in, A to the X. X is the number that is plugged in the top register up here. Now, if you look at the number 15 itself, though, there are only really 2 cases that you would guess. One of them has a period of 2, and one of them has a period of 4. And so that means that all the rest of these multiplications go away because they're multiplications by 1. Thus, you can simplify this thing to being just a controlled A or a controlled A squared, leaving an extra qubit here for this notion of the Nyquist criteria, and conclude that 7 qubits are needed to factor the number 15. Furthermore, there are a few more simplifications that are in some sense reasonable, and I'll come back to that issue in just a moment. So for example, instead of a controlled multiplication, you can see using a sense of compilation, take the multiplier and realize that it turns into 2 controlled NOT gates for the controlled A, and into a sequence of 2 3 qubit gates and a few controlled NOT gates for the controlled multiplication by A squared. And then compounding these together, this is the final circuit that one gets, which tests both the hard and easy cases. And the lesson from history is that we did this in about 2001. Here's the molecule with 7 qubits. We proved that with high probability, 15 is 3 times 5, and this is a sequence of about 200 pulses done with nuclear magnetic resonance, which was used to do that. I don't mean to explain this to you, but rather to give it to you in context, especially for you here at Waterloo, who have seen such experiments go on, say in Dave Corey's lab and Raymond Laflamme's lab. And I want to impress upon you how these are not easy experiments. This is the lab that we had at IBM doing this with Leon van der Sypen and Matthias Stefan. But it wasn't always a joy of working in such a lab. This is one of our experiences when our magnet quenched. And when you quench a magnet like that, you immediately fall to the floor. Instead, I stood up with my camera and took a picture until I was swatted down by my graduate student. Nevertheless, what we did was to realize this experiment. And then subsequent to that, a number of other realizations have happened. So in 2007, that work with NMR was 2001. So 6 years later, a linear optics realization was done. Now in that case, the group only did what we call the easy case. So that is the period 2 case. And they only needed 3 qubits. And in fact, soon thereafter, a group using a superconducting qubit system did a similar experiment. Now that only requires 2 controlled knots. This linear optics system is also pulse selected, it is not deterministic. And in addition to that, soon thereafter in 2007 to 2011, the number 21 was factored. And look, 21 requires even fewer qubits than factoring 15, and thus was inspired a wonderful paper by John Smolin, Graham Smith, and Alex Vargo from IBM, showing that for all numbers n that you might wish to factor, there always exists an a that you can choose such that its order is 2. Thus, the factoring algorithm reduces this circuit. It only needs one qubit. You really don't need the rest of Shor's algorithm. In fact, they show that you could factor numbers with a coin, and they demonstrated in their paper that you can factor extremely large numbers with a coin. So I should end my talk here, perhaps. But the story, therefore, is that you can go far too far in compiling circuits into something so simple that you just print out the results and never run anything meaningful on your quantum computer. So how do we toe this line? In fact, the very last sentence of their paper is that actually running algorithms on such tiny experiments is a somewhat frivolous endeavor. Now, if I have ever seen a gauntlet laid on the stage, it is thus. And of all the papers I've read from these folks, this is the most British of all of them. So what do we do? Well, this challenge is to move from the small scale demonstrations to something that is meaningful, where you can say you've used something like a million gates and can access 100,000 qubits. And to do this, the real test is to test systems and not just devices. And as is known very well here at Perimeter, led by work by people like Dan Gottesman, the idea is to test the constructs of fault-tolerant quantum computation, to be able to do quantum computation in the presence of a finite amount of noise and do it as reliably as you would desire. This is to make this possible, needs encoded qubits with quantum error correction codes, a split between codes used for memory and for computation, a supply of ancilla states, which I like to call power supply states, that drive the computation forward, and exquisite classical control. And so if you really want to show something in these demonstrations, you really should show some of these elements. And in addition, let me add one more to this, which is that you can understand what your system is doing so well that you get a predictive model. You can design your quantum computer and based on your model of it, say how well it will work without ever having built a single piece of hardware. And that is actually how all modern classical computers are done. Intel's next generation CPU is completely simulated to its last detail long before you actually go and tape out the chip and fabricate it. Now, of course, we cannot simulate our quantum computer because then we would be able to simulate Shor's algorithm and do away with the need for it. But I claim that you can simulate the system well enough to be able to predict how well it would work without getting the answers that it would produce. That's an important distinction. So what can we do to demonstrate these? I claim that Shor's algorithm can provide a meaningful and stringent test of four of these criteria: scalability, integration, classical control, and quantum control of quantum computers. And what I would like to show to you in the next 15 or 20 minutes, in the middle of my talk, is that we have done this to an extent with trapped ion quantum computers, demonstrating Shor's algorithm to make a point about cascaded, high fidelity, deterministic multi-qubit gates, fast feed-forward control, which is necessary for fault-tolerant quantum computation, and the integration of quantum memory with quantum computation simultaneously. So there's a certain set used for memory and a certain set for computation, and the computation does not disturb the memory. And finally, that we have a predictive model for this, so that maybe we can make some grounded judgment calls about how large a quantum computer could be made with trapped ion systems. So let me try to convince you of these four things. But before going to the details of that, I'd like to start with a little bit of perspective about trapped ion quantum computation just in general, so you can understand how it fits in with the rest of the experimental implementations that are used today. If we look back in history, in quantum information science and technology, circa 2002, these were the kinds of implementations that everyone was talking about and working on. Superconductors, as led by Yasunobu Nakamura, were very promising, with Rabi oscillations being shown for the first time ever around this era. Quantum dots with single qubits and Rabi oscillations. And I don't know if you remember, but the entire nation of Australia, approximately, very good approximation, was working on embedded phosphorus in silicon, the Bruce Cain model, where one created artificial atoms of phosphorus underneath gates on silicon. Trapped atoms, both neutral and ions, were just beginning. There was nuclear magnetic resonance, which is running wild. 2002 is a year after our factoring demonstration. Cavity quantum electrodynamics and optics. And let me give you a scorecard of what things were like about that time. So with these superconducting qubits, we were seeing about 2-qubit systems, and maybe 1 2-qubit gate had been realized at that time. With quantum dots, 1 qubit, no 2-qubit gates. With phosphorus and silicon, maybe, if you really stretched it, 1 qubit, and no 2-qubit gates. With atoms, maybe 1 2-qubit gate, which was the controlled knot gate demonstrated by Chris Monroe. With NMR, the factoring experiment, you could argue, set the limit there, 7 qubits with 22-qubit gates. Cavity QED, maybe 1 2-qubit gate, and optics, maybe 1 2-qubit gate. Now, what happened is that at this time, people started to realize that the ingredients for making large-scale systems were very different from making small-scale systems. So let's zoom ahead 10 years and see how the landscape changed. So as of last year, for example, ions, circuit QED with superconductors, quantum dots, nitrogen vacancies, optical lattices, and linear optics are arguably among the most interesting realizations going on today and successful. Where did NMR go? Well, largely NMR has fallen off of the map of the community working on quantum computing for scalable quantum computing because there's no way of doing a measurement on a qubit and feeding that measurement forward in a time which is fast compared with the decoherence time of a qubit. So you can't really make the fault-tolerant quantum computation constructs, largely, okay? So, and there are other systems which went that way. Ions circa last year had reached a limit of around 14 qubits, 10 2-qubit gates, 4 3-qubit gates. Circuit QED had about 4 qubits, 1 3-qubit gate, in fact. Quantum dots, still no 3-qubit gates, but at last a 2-qubit gate. Nitrogen vacancies, an up-and-coming system, 1 2-qubit gate, some limitations, though. Optical lattices, about 1 2-qubit gate. And then linear optics had had some promising results with multiple 2-qubit gates, creating a GHZ state. So what I would like to tell you about now is about trapped ions and why there's been so much success with creating 14-qubit systems and so forth. The reason is because of this structure. This particular structure is that of a calcium 40 ion, and it has this nice pair of atomic levels between the S state and the D state, which has a very long lifetime. This state, if you create a superposition of S1/2 and D5/2, has a lifetime of about 1 second because of the quadrature polar nature of this transition. It is forbidden to have a dipole transition. It has a frequency of 729 nanometers, and it turns out that one can just make lasers at that frequency, which are very stable. And there also happen to be nice lasers which allow you to move information around and prepare the system in whatever state you would like among the other levels present. So given this ion and state, what was accomplished up to this time of Abronk last year were these kinds of capabilities for quantum computation. State preparation of something like 99.5% fidelity, coherence times which range to about a second time scale, measurement time scales, which are as fast as, say, a few hundred microseconds. Gate times, which are on the order of 20 to 100 microseconds. And gate fidelities of single qubits of 3 to 4 9s of fidelity. Gate fidelities of multiple qubit gates, known as Molnar-Sorensen gates, of between 99% and lower, like 94 to 96% for multiple ions. And ways of starting to do memory using something the Innsbruck group calls a hiding pulse, which takes about 45 microseconds or so. Now, in the following, I want to emphasize that the results I'll be showing you and many of the apparatus I will also be showing you are work from a joint research project done together with the University of Innsbruck, the University of California, Berkeley, and the University of Mainz. And so the principal investigators of this joint project are Reinhard Blatt, Ferdinand Schmidt-Kaler, and Hartmut Hefner at Berkeley. And this has been a really quite an interesting experience moving forward together as a joint project, almost verging into the notion of doing high energy physics together, because it's been such a large and grand effort. But it starts at a very small level. Suppose I give you an atom and I ask you to hold on to it so you don't lose it. Neil, here's an atom. Hold it. Don't lose it. Where did it go? It's on your nose. How do you do that? So you know it's the same atom. Look, there are 10 to the 23 of them in just a cubic centimeter. So what you do first is you ionize it, and then you put some electrodes around it. Now it's a charged particle. You make it a very good vacuum. And what's going to happen to this charged particle? Well, it's clearly going to move towards its oppositely charged partner. So these are metal electrodes, and this is a positively charged thing. You'll see that ion moving forward like that. But lo and behold, just a moment later, I'm going to switch the voltages. Now the trajectory of this ion is going to move. So it's going to move and try to hit this negative one, and then so on and so forth. And this idea won the Nobel Prize, 1989, by Wolfgang Pauli. It's a very beautiful one, and it underlies one of the one half of all of analytical chemistry today, mass spectroscopy. And here's an example of one of the quadruple mass filters that are made. Lasers can also be shot into the side now to now address these ions and perform quantum operations via laser cooling. And so a number of ions have been laser cooled, and the techniques of these were pioneered by Dave Wineland and company, for which he won the Nobel Prize last year. Now, the modern ion traps, which I'll tell you about, that are used for quantum computation, take this idea, turn it 45 degrees, and then smash the electrodes into a plane. So now we have minus, plus, minus. And what will happen is that the ions will float above the surface of this electrode, where the vacuum chamber way off in infinity is the counter middle electrode. And to this set of electrodes on a plane, we can now easily get access from a laser from a wide variety of directions. We can also put these chips on other environments, such as a liquid helium bath, and integrate devices into this. And so now we have this very interesting system, which is like a composite of a condensed matter device together with an atomic physics device. And this is what has been driving the field of trapped ions forward in the last decade or so. There are segmented traps that look linear like this, and traps which look cylindrical like this. And the idea is that many of these traps are now microfabricatable with precision. And now you're no longer talking about an ion trap that is made by a Swiss watchmaker who you hire and put in the basement of your building. I kid you not, this is exactly how the Innsbruck traps are made, the older ones, but now by a mass process. And you can trap ions like this in the middle of a small region of your microfabricated trap. So I'll tell you now about some experiments. This is the MIT cryogenic ion trap. In this system, we can trap 1, 2, 3, 4, and a whole chain. This is a Wigner crystal of trapped ions. So the operations that one performs on these ions fall into two general categories. One is to perform single qubit operations, which involve addressing the laser to hit one ion at a time inside such kinds of crystals. This performs an operation which is a single qubit rotation, or collective gates. And these collective gates either happen as monochromatic beams, which then affect the total angular momentum of the system, basically rotating every single qubit identically. Or if you use two beams of light, a bichromatic beam, say from two opposite directions, then you get a very interesting collective interaction, which is known as the Mohmer-Sorensen gate, that rotates about the Casimir operator of the system, the Sx squared. So this is a collective gate, and that allows one to entangle systems. So I will simply assert here, without proof, that the Mohmer-Sorensen gate, together with these total spin flips and these single qubit rotations around just the z-axis, are enough to get a unitary universal set. And for example, one can create a Toffoli gate using a sequence of such pulses, and these fit what one can do in the experiment very well. Okay, so let me now move to what we did for factoring. I've given you some background about what we can do. Now, what we actually did do is to demonstrate these four goals: fast feedback control, quantum memory with computation, high fidelity cascaded gates, and predictive modeling. And we did that in the face of these kinds of issues. For example, in the hard case of factoring, remember that there were 7 qubits here and a number of gates. This would involve over 200 of the Malmer-Sorensen gates and rotation gates. And because of the fidelity of the gates, naively, you would get an output fidelity that's unsustainable, less than 10%. There's also the length of the time of these gates. The total number of these, the time that you would need, would end up being more than a millisecond, which is long compared with the coherence time that you might have due to some field fluctuations. And issues with addressing and issues with isolation, such as readout. If you read out one qubit, it can decohere nearby qubits. This is an issue, for example, that NMR had. Okay, so let me give you some new ideas. I'll highlight the results and then I'll explain some of the implications. So one of the new ideas was to use additional states in the system as memory. So for example, the qubit is the S and D state here. And if one applies these two extra dark red transition laser frequencies, then you can move the qubit into the D prime S prime state and thus hide it. A second idea is something we call feed forward control for factoring for the quantum Fourier transform. And this is demonstrated by looking at how the quantum Fourier transform circuit works. Here's a QFT. There's a Hadamard controlled rotation, Hadamard double controlled rotation. Now, if one measures at the output of this, these wires are then turned into classical results. You project this qubit with a meter into a classical bit. That classical bit controls this one. Note that all these controlled 2-qubit gates now turn into 1-qubit gates. This is a result from Griffiths and New from 1996. Alyosha Kitaev noted separately of this that you can utilize this construct to unravel the Fourier transform such that it becomes a sequence of single qubit operations with classical feed forward controls. You do this measurement, you feed it into the same qubit that you reinitialized, and then another qubit that you reinitialize here for the third step in this demonstration. And this is an ideal way to do quantum Fourier transforms and to unravel the Shor algorithm, specifically for trapped ions, because trapped ions have a nice natural way to store memory and to be able to accomplish the reinitialization within the coherence time needed, and also to be able to reset qubits on demand. I'll show you a little bit about that in terms of our results. So here's an experiment that was performed at Innsbruck, which demonstrates the Fourier transform of 0, 0, 0. 0, 0, 0 is one state. When you Fourier transform one state, you expect to get a superposition of all states. So that superposition of all states looks like this. And I'll flip color a few times by accident. So let me note those for you. Here, the ideal is in blue and experiment is in red. And so for this input state, you get an equal superposition of all values. For this input state, you get an equal superposition of 4 values, and then here for 2 values. And you can see that the experiment and the ideal case match up pretty well. This is the experiment done with the 1-qubit feed-forward quantum Fourier transform, and it has a fidelity of about 95% statistical squared overlap. Whereas if you use 3 qubits, in the normal way without feed-forward, because 2-qubit gates are involved, the fidelity drops dramatically to about 71%. Again, this is results from the Innsbruck group led by Thomas Mons and Philippe Schindler. And it shows very nicely the potential for doing feed-forward. And so our next step was to demonstrate feed-forward together with memory, because you like the measurement that is used in the feed-forward not to disturb other qubits that are being stored in the system. And we demonstrated this by using a problem known as order finding. And order finding is a Fourier transform-based quantum algorithm that finds the period of a permutation, for example. So the period is R, and you'd like to find the minimum integer R which is a power of permutation, such that you get back to identity. These are examples of an order 3, order 1, and order 4 permutation. And the permutation is performed just as the modular exponentiation it does, happens in the Fourier, in the Shor algorithm before the Fourier transform. And the structure looks much like the Shor algorithm. This is an example for a 5-qubit circuit that we developed originally a long time ago together with Richard Cleave that performs powers of permutations here followed by the inverse Fourier transform. And the modern version of it that we implemented with trapped ions uses feed forward in memory. So here you can see the Fourier transform replaced by the measured Fourier transform with feed forward, as well as some extra hiding pulses that take these qubits, put them into memory while this one is being measured, and then brings it out of memory, and then similarly over here. So this system, although it looks like you only have 3 qubits, actually has 5 qubits because there are 2 extra qubits used for the memory of the bottom 2 register here. So this is a table showing a number of permutations, 5 of them. This is the identity permutation, a order 1 permutation, and so forth. And these are the experimental results from those permutations. So order 1, 2, 3, and 4, showing again now the ideal case. Ideal is in red and experiment is in blue. And we have a fairly good match, except for the order 3 case, which is hard to do with this small number of ions in Fourier transform. So these are aliasing effects. But in any case, the ideal and the experiment agree very well. And in fact, we have a fidelity in excess of 75%, typically in the high 80% regime. So we have now shown feed-forward control. We've shown memory. Now we need to show the ability to do complex gates beyond just controlled knots and controlled rotations. Now before going there, I want to show you one piece of detail about the experiment, just to give you a taste of what the technology requires. The problem is that one needs to perform entangling operations on a subset of qubits, despite having a large register of qubits. So I showed you earlier how a sequence of pulses could hide qubits from memory. It also turns out that there are many other levels one can use. So these are known as the magnetic Zeeman sublevels of the D5/2 level. In this sequence of operations that is performed, Philippe Schindler demonstrated that addressing can be performed to the lasers, to the ions with the lasers, to allow the qubit levels, shown here as the bottom S1/2 and the D-1/2 here, and move those into 2 of the D levels so that they then become unaffected by the rest of the operations. So there are a lot of these details. I'm not sharing them all with you, but this is a rather complex experiment that was carried out. So let me return now to the next steps, which is memory, feed forward, and now cascaded 3-qubit gates. And in this case, our goal is to perform the hard Shor algorithm. The reason I went through the order finding example is because it turns out that factoring numbers is a special case of order finding. If you find the order of this function, it is equivalent to finding the period of the exponential modular exponentiation I showed you earlier. And so the Shor algorithm works by you choose a random A, you find the order of A to the X mod N, this is a function of X, and then you calculate the GCD of A to the R divided by 2 plus or minus 1 with N. And for 15, these are the values of A that you can choose that are very representative of the possibilities. 11 squared modulo 15 is 121, which gives you back 1. So the order of 11 is 2. And you can see the numbers give you 3 and 5. The order of 7 is 4, because 7 squared comes back to 4, cubed gives you 13. And then the fourth power gives you back 1. And in this similar spirit, one gets the factors of 15. Now, as the order increases, the circuit gets harder and harder to do. So here's the factoring 15 circuit written out with various A's. If one only does the order 2 case of being 11, so A is 11, N is 15, the circuit for multiplying by 11 is just 2 controlled NOT gates, as I mentioned earlier. If one wants to do the hard case, the circuit turns into two quantum Fredkin gates and two controlled NOT gates. And it is the cascading of these two quantum Fredkin gates which we wanted to test and demonstrate works out well for the hard case. So here are the results. I'll simply skip to the answer here and show you that now here experiment is in blue and ideal is in red. Both for the easy case and for the hard case, we have better than 90% squared statistical overlap agreement of the results for the two cases. Despite this having the hard case, having two three qubit quantum Fredkin gates. We had expected this, if you had been naive about the simulation, to have a fidelity that was far lower than this because the inherent fidelity of a single three qubit gate is not that high. About 95%, as I showed earlier. And there are many more gates involved in this. So the reason this was all possible is because we had built a very large simulator system, which takes as input the algorithm and the model, compiles it into a sequence of pulses, and then simulates this identically with what the experiment is performed. So the pulse compiler produces something for both of these systems. It's analyzed and then fed back to be able to make this converge just to understand what the error sources are. So this set of plots shows now in addition to the experiment and the ideal case, experiment in red, ideal in blue, green simulation. And we get a very good agreement between simulation and experiment, in most cases well within the error bars. And the most important thing about this data I show you is that there are no fit parameters. Everything is based entirely upon system calibration and measurements done on the system. These results are from the order finding experiment, and these results are from the factoring experiment. From analyzing the data, we understand that the major sources of error are addressing errors due to crosstalk and the inability to move the laser around sufficiently fast. And dephasing, namely some servo line width feedback, servo feedback loop line width issues, and magnetic field fluctuations. Also limiting, but much less so, was the spontaneous emission lifetime and the measurement and the gate times. So we believe we have a predictive model that is able to tell us how a large quantum computer would work if we did so. So now let me try to stretch your imagination with one last topic. And ask, what should you do if you want to build a very large quantum factoring engine? And move back to the regime of theory. And let's talk about for a moment this modular exponentiation, which is at the heart of the Shor algorithm. Could you do that in a uniquely quantum mechanical way and not just use the classical algorithms like those I've shown you? It is not a surprise that the middle part only has controlled knots and Toffee gates because it's really only implementing a classical reversible multiplication scheme. Indeed, it is well known that there are a variety of ways to approach this hardest part of doing the modular exponentiation. But I would like to ask what is the most scalable way of doing this? And if there is something uniquely quantum mechanical that you could do and that would give a meaningful exercise of testing scalability. The prior art in this business was set by many people, among whom are Christoph Zacka, who worked here. And they include, for example, the binary shift and add multiplier and the quantum Fourier shift and add multiplier, which result in a number of qubits, which is linear in the number of digits of the number being factored, here little lowercase n, and a gate count, which is polynomial, like either n squared or n cubed, and a depth which can go as low as order n log n. But a real clincher for things like ion traps is the number of controlled, not doubly controlled gates, so three qubit gates, which go as approximately n squared for both of the well-established approaches to doing this. If you are factoring a number classically, like using the chips that are running in some of your cryptographic engines, DES chips, a technique that is used is known as Montgomery multiplication. This classical algorithm has as its goal to output C, the product of X and B modulo N. And the way it does this fast is by moving first. So multiplication is not bad. It's a sequence of additions, x times b. If you want to calculate the product modulo another number, though, one then has to, conceptually, you can imagine, do a division by n, another multiplication, and then a subtraction, right? And that's a lot of pain. And in fact, when you want to make that quantum mechanical, it's even worse of a pain. What is done classically is not to do those trial divisions and subtractions, but rather typically to move into another representation of the number known as the Montgomery representation. Simply speaking, it is to take this number and multiply it by a large power of 2. That's easy to do digitally. You just shift the number of bits up. So when you do this, then to compute the product of two of these, modulo n, with an inverse of r in between, which is just a downshifting again, one can use a subalgorithm known as the Montgomery reduction. And this can be done fast, half as many operations as needed for the normal modular multiplication. In the world of cryptography, these factors of two mean a great deal in terms of speed. So there's a catch, though. This is not the correct definition of the Montgomery representation. There's actually a modulo n that also goes along for the ride. And unfortunately, to then create a number in the Montgomery representation means that you have to do a multiplication modulo n. You do this again using the Montgomery reduction. So in other words, with Montgomery multiplication, you have to do 3 of these Montgomery reductions, one to move it in, one to compute the product, and then one to move the result C back out to get C from C bar. Okay, so that doesn't sound like a win, unless you're doing many, many multiplications, like in modular exponentiation. So you move into the Montgomery representation, you do a lot of multiplications using the Montgomery reduction, and then you move back out of the Montgomery reduction, and then you have a tremendous savings. Could we do the same quantum mechanically? And how would it be different, perhaps, or the same? Well, there's a cost, a factor of 2 needed to turn any traditional circuit into a reversible one. We haven't found a way around this yet. But there is some very good news, though. There is a trade-off that you can do by splitting the tasks between classical and quantum. Because in this modular exponentiation we need for factoring, we know the number that we're trying to multiply by. It's A. So there's a great deal that you can move into classical pre-computation that does not require compilation. The end of all the story is that we have a circuit. It does the Montgomery multiplication in this domain known as Fourier multiplication, as I mentioned in the table earlier. There are 2 major steps of it. You compute the Montgomery product, and then you uncompute to erase the input. This is just a forward computation. It involves controlled. Several Fourier transforms. It looks like a very large circuit, but what is very interesting is that if you use this Montgomery multiplication first here, let me show you binary, the binary case. It can be just as effective as the binary shift and add multiplier, and moving it into the Fourier domain, then you can get a tremendous savings in the number of doubly controlled gates, moving from n squared down to order n. And this is a real boon for the scalability of quantum Fourier, quantum modular exponentiation, and as we contend, a good candidate, therefore, for testing. So let me close on this note and summarize what I hope I've been able to share with you. Factoring 15 has hard and easy cases, and we have demonstrated realization of Shor's algorithm for that with 90% fidelity results. We have demonstrated that fast feedback forward control is possible with a trapped ion system. And by the way, this has not been done for quantum computation in any other physical system, to my knowledge, yet. We have demonstrated the use of a 5-ion system with approximately 9 qubits of Hilbert space, where 4 of the qubits were memory. We've demonstrated a cascade of 3-qubit Fredkin gates. And then we've demonstrated a predictive model of this system. With this predictive model, we draw the conclusion that the scalability of the system is limited largely by technical issues. In the second part of my talk, I described to you how we have constructed a different approach to doing the modular exponentiation that has fewer required numbers of Toffoli gates, or 3-qubit gates. And that this is therefore a wonderful building block for modular exponentiation that tests not just fault tolerance ideas, but quantum approaches to doing this core part of the algorithm. Based on this, we've proposed an experiment to factor the number 21 with a order 6 test case and the quantum Fourier Montgomery multiplier that requires 7 ions and 52 Molmer-Sorensen gates. This number 52 has frightened our collaborators a great deal, but also given them a great deal of resolve to try to realize. One needs 98% fidelity Molmer-Sorensen gates, which is about 3 percentage points higher than is possible today in lab. But I hope I've been able to share with you, in conclusion, my conviction that in doing all of this work, running quantum algorithms on tiny experiments can indeed be a serious endeavor. Thank you very much.
So as usual, we like to give students a chance for the first questions. So any?
Hi, thank you so much for that talk. That was absolutely wonderful. When you talk about technical issues limiting the scalability, how surmountable do you think these technical issues are in the next few years or next few decades?
I think that one of the underlying differences is that I categorize them as being not ones of fundamental principle. And thus, in many ways, one of the greatest challenges for this field is that those questions are largely uninteresting to physicists. And so what will it take to do this? It will take a cultural change of the field of quantum information moving from science to engineering. And there are a lot of beautiful engineering questions there. And for example, one of them is move the laser beam from here to here as fast as you can. And 1 microsecond is not fast enough. And it cannot jitter back and forth. And its phase has to be absolutely stable when you move it here and then move it back. And this is an underlying question, right? Another one is create an electronic pulse generator that produces as square a pulse as possible at the end of the wire, even though you're this long away from the wire and have some impedance problems. And furthermore, you have to do this with 30 wires and really fast. And so a lot of technology has to go into developing this. I think that how fast it will happen depends on the scale of effort that goes into doing this. So we would go to our esteemed leadership and ask for funding. I hope that answers your question as best as I can.
Any other questions from students? Okay, maybe throw it open to questions from other people. And of course, the students can continue to ask questions.
Hi. What would you say right now would be the cost of an average qubit?
I'm sorry?
The cost of an average qubit in
what would happen if we lost a qubit?
No, no. What's the cost of an average qubit?
What is the average cost of an average qubit?
Yeah.
Well, if I'd like to be an average qubit, an average qubit is in a mixed state. So a mixed state is in an identity density matrix. So I would say that's really quite inexpensive. I'd be willing to sell you one for a Canadian dollar. No, I see. You want a better qubit. I have to say that the experiments behind this, to answer your question more seriously, have been very expensive. I would say that the original experiment where we factored 15 with a 7-qubit NMR quantum computer was 4 years of effort funded by DARPA in the US that involved something like between 4 and 16 personnel working on it. And from that, you can judge about how much it costs. So the the interesting qubits are the very large ones that are successful, the large team generated qubits. I think if you would like just one qubit, it's very easy for me to turn on a laser pointer and shoot them at you, and so here you go, here are a lot of qubits headed your way. Each one of those photons, I think I just gave you 10 to the 40 photons, has a polarization, which is a wonderful qubit. But then again, they're not very useful to you because they kind of splattered all over the place. So it's a very tricky question that. If you want to ask how much will it cost to make a 21-qubit quantum computer, it depends on the technology as well.
Next question. Well, maybe I can ask mine. So this multiplication that you presented, that's intended just for these small things. I mean, is that right? It looks like asymptotically it's not as good as fast multiplication tricks.
So the prefactor is entirely due to our inability to make an efficient way to reverse it right now. And I believe that if we reverse it instead of by doing the pebbling step with the inverse of the function, by reversing it at a finer grain, then we should be able to bring that prefactor down and be much more than competitive. Otherwise, the thing that is scaling much better is the number of Toffleys, even though the number of qubits and the circuit depth are only comparable right now to the existing schemes.
I was a little surprised by what you said about needing more engineers interested in quantum information, because according to my understanding, MIT had an IQWISE program that ended just a few years ago, and IQWISE stood in part for science and engineering. So I was curious about what interactions you have had with that community, how they aren't sufficient, what you're looking for, and what the status is.
Okay. So let me begin by saying that I'm the faculty leader of the IQWISE program. And it has been this program which has opened my eyes to the need for people who can cross that boundary. And indeed, we have something like 60% physics students in that program and maybe 40% engineering students in that program. As a clarification, the program is still ongoing. We still have students active in it and will continue to be so until perhaps the end of next year. And I think the hardest part is getting the engineering faculty to talk with the science faculty about quantum computation. It really happens completely in parallel. And what we would like is for this effort not just to be realized as one which is an engineering one at the scale of any, say, university efforts. For example, if you were going to build a modern airplane, we know now today much better ways to build engines, jet engines, using rocket technology that would be able to bring us from, say, Toronto to Boston in half an hour or 20 minutes instead, most of it taken up by the launch and the landing. But there's no university in the world that would actually build that plane because it's too much of an engineering challenge. Something similar is happening to quantum computation. It's moving into a scale of almost outside the tabletop if you want to build something that is going to be seriously capable of seriously factoring large numbers. And that's an institutional change. So I hope I've addressed your question by saying the students are leading this by and large. There's a great deal of cross-connect between science and engineering among the students with programs like IQWISE, and I'm glad that you've noticed. But the engineering and the science faculty have yet to connect strongly, and then the institutional changes are even a longer timescale in coming. And I think all of this needs to happen for large-scale fault-tolerant, reliable quantum computers to become a reality, particularly in your lifetimes.
Hello. Thank you for a great presentation. My question might strike you as a little naive. I read an article in Science magazine two or three months ago in which they talked, it seemed to me that the implementation, the particular implementation of trapped ions was completely different, and they had a completely different set of scaling issues. Can you comment on whether that's actually a correct interpretation, and whether there are in fact several different types of ways in which you could implement trapped ions for quantum computation?
Okay, let me extrapolate from your reading of this article in Science and suggests that if it was a March issue, it was the article written by Chris Monroe and company. Jung Sung Kim, who is a very close collaborator of mine. And we are actually speaking about the same systems and the same scaling issues, but I have extrapolated far forward from that. The specific ones I've communicated in this talk are related to this experiment. And so the factoring experiment that I've shown and shared with you today here did not use a microfabricated surface electrode trap. Okay? And thus it did not move around ions, for example. All our ions stayed in a chain of five ions and the laser was moved around. In other ion trap systems, the ions can be moved instead. And so there are many interesting trade-offs, and I did not touch on some of those.
Very quickly follow up on that. I read a quantitative 1 over d to the 4 law there. I mean, it was some kind of scaling. The
very
noise
good.
would decrease as d to the 4. So that, I mean, could you comment on why that fourth power comes in there?
Absolutely. So as you have observed, what is known in the literature and the community is that ions seem to see a noise as they approach the surface. Let the distance of the ion to the surface be d, and the noise appears to go as 1 over d to the 4th. So if you want to make a smaller, denser, larger number of qubits ions on your chip, you clearly want them to get closer. And then if they get closer, they're easier to move around, but then they see noise. Now, why does an ion see noise when it's above a metal? It's because the metal is not a real metal. The metal has grain boundaries. The metal has surface defects. The metal has things that are moving around on its surface, even at the frequency of 1 megahertz, which is the oscillation frequency of the ion, which is actually a fascinating subject to condensed matter physicists, because it is unexpected to see such dynamics happening at 1 megahertz on the top of a surface of metal. So it happens to be that my group has been pioneering the use of cryogenic techniques to reduce that noise. The reason it goes as 1 over d to the 4th is because they're likely due to patch potentials moving around on the surface. If it were Johnson noise, it would be 1 over d squared, where d squared is the area, and that gives you the resistance of the area creating the noise. Recently, it has been shown that in addition to our work on suppressing the noise by 3 orders of magnitude by cooling down the system to 4K, like the example I showed you, the group of Dave Wineland at NIST has shown that you can remove the noise also by about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude by cleaning the surface, and it stays low noise afterwards. So that problem is now widely believed to have been resolved, at least in principle, by the cryogenic technique or by surface cleaning. Now, I don't mean to say it's not interesting, because it turns out that because of the ability of ions to sense this level of noise, the ions are a fantastic probe of surface physics. And one should utilize that, but that's not the topic of my talk today.
That article seemed to suggest that the next step was several thousand qubits, but the N being 21, I mean, can you just, is that, first of all, is that correct to say that the next step for that, for the set of issues they were discussing, was something of the order of 10 to the 4?
I have to say, I prefer to be modest and only seek to have 7 qubits instead of 5 as a first step. And we'll see how far it goes from there. But I would like to have results step by step. I think that the future is very promising for ion trap systems that could reach the level of 1,000 or thousands of ions in the near future. I think that of all the physical implementations of quantum computing systems today, it will likely be a combination of things like atoms and solid state, which will move forward beyond these kinds of limits of just 1,000 to get to, say, 10 to the 4.